Hello and welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. It is open forum today, and I've got three lines open right now. So if you have a question about the Catholic faith, about the Catholic Church in Holy Week, maybe you have a particular question about what it is we Catholics believe about the death and resurrection of Jesus, all that stuff is welcome. Anything having to do with the Catholic faith is welcome. 888-318-7884 is the number. If you're not Catholic, we'd love it if you'd call. If you got a question about why Jesus had to die on the cross, or what that Last Supper was about. We're celebrating all that stuff this week. The number for non-Catholics is 888-318-7884. If you're Catholic, you are also welcome to call. 888-318-7884. That's the number for Catholics. And we have a wonderful guest for you this hour. Mark Brumley is, as I said last hour, the president of Ignatius Press, the largest and most important Catholic publisher in the galaxy. In the galaxy.
Galaxy.
This galaxy that we call the Milky Way.
Milky Way galaxy. Okay. It includes Alpha, Beta, Gamma, and Delta quadrants.
All four quadrants. I don't care what quadrant you're in. If you say Ignatius Press, they go, are those the ones who published? And then they say some wonderful Catholic book, and it is you. And they, and movies,
that's right.
Too. And movies, too.
Except when they hear my name, then they say, I think that guy has a book published by Catholic Answers.
Yes, the president of Ignatius Press has a book published by Catholic Answers. And we don't tell people this, but the reason for that is that the editors at Ignatius Press rejected the book. They thought—
That's right. That's right.
No,
it's not up to snuff, not up to the standards.
I'm sure that's not what happened. It must have to do with your long association and former employment here at Catholic Answers.
It did, because I told Carl at one point, Carl Keating, when he was the president of Catholic Answers, that one of these days I was going to write a book. I described the book to him, and I said, if I write it, I will give you the first option or right of first refusal or all that.
Yeah.
And that was before I was working for Ignatius Press. And so then I finished the manuscript after I started working for Ignatius Press and, you know, kind of felt obligated to
Keep your word.
And of course.
And the rest is history. A book called The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics.
Of apologetics, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well, did I get the
Not
title
Catholics.
Right? And you were about
you
to get
it.
The title wrong?
I started to get it wrong. Yeah, I almost got it wrong. You can believe that.
Yeah, it has become more or less my habit to somehow get the name of your book wrong. And then
It's become a psychological thing.
It's a psychological block.
So whenever people hear that I'm on the show, they're sitting by their radio thinking, how's Cy going to get the title wrong this time?
Right. But I didn't. Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics.
Amen.
We got a whole bunch of people on the line, Mark.
Let's go for it.
All right. Let me give the number again, 888-31-TRUTH. And let's go to Mary in Hyde Park, Massachusetts, listening on the Station of the Cross. Mary, thanks for starting us off this hour. Your question for Mark Brumley.
We've got a group of women in our area who are advocating to be able to have women be ordained as priests. And much to my distress, there are also some priests that are saying that we should at least hear them out. Now, I know it's completely against Catholic teaching, and I know that we've had at least a couple of popes state that this can never be an option. But can you help me with some resources that I can specifically use, like Pope X, Pope Y, or?
Well, I can mention specifically Pope John Paul II in a document called Ordinatio Sacerdotalis reaffirmed the longstanding Catholic teaching that the ministerial priesthood is for men alone, that it's a male reality. And so John Paul II reaffirmed that, of course. His predecessor, Paul VI, taught that, and all the predecessor popes taught that. And then more recently, Benedict XVI has affirmed that. Pope Francis has affirmed that. So that's not something that's going to change. So that's clear. Now, if you want a good book on the topic, I would recommend a book by a fellow named Manfred Hauke called Woman in the Priesthood, published by Ignatius Press. There are other resources out there. Sister Sarah Butler, who used to be a proponent of women's ordination, but who changed her mind, wrote a book on the male priesthood, the title of which I can't recall off the top of my head right now. I should have thought about that before I brought it up, but I would recommend that. There's also a book by Cardinal Mueller that deals with the issue of the priesthood and the diaconate. That's the title of it. So he addresses this question of the ordination of women. So there are a lot of resources out there on the subject. Now, part of it, in addition to pointing you to resources, we should just say a little something about why the church ordains only men. And the answer to that is partly because this is the tradition of the church that comes down from Jesus. But to try to understand it, we have to understand that the ministerial priesthood is the way in which Christ's priesthood is expressed in relation to the church. And how do we understand Christ's priesthood in relation to the church? The whole church shares in the priestly reality of the priesthood of Jesus. Jesus is a mediator between God and man. He offers sacrifice. He makes God present among us. These are all aspects of his priesthood. The whole church shares in that priestly reality, but the whole church shares in that priestly reality by virtue of her, and I'm underscoring the word her, union with Jesus. And so we ask, what's the nature of that union? What's the concept or the term or the idea that we would use that God has revealed that expresses or conveys the nature that the whole church of the whole church's union with Jesus, and that is a spousal relationship. The church stands in relation to Jesus as a wife to a husband, or put it differently, Jesus stands in relation to the church as a husband to his wife. So there's a spousal reality. So Jesus's identity as priest is an identity that's bound up with that husbandly reality. And I and you, Mary, and Cy are priestly because of our being part of the feminine reality of the church. The whole church taken together, not just individuals, but the whole church taken together has a priestly identity or priestly quality because she is in a spousal relationship with the church. Paul talks about this in Ephesians chapter 5 when he says the relationship between husband and wife is like the relationship of Christ and his church. Just as husband and wife come together and become one flesh, in a certain sense they become a one being, so Christ and the church are one being. We retain our distinctive and complementary identities in marriage as husband and wife, and likewise Christ and the church, but there is a kind of union or coming together or oneness. So yes, it's true that all of us, all baptized persons, are priestly, have a priestly identity, but the reason that is because we are part of the bride of Christ, the church, whereas the ministerial priest doesn't just represent the bride of Christ, the church. The ministerial priest represents Jesus as husband of the church, and that's the difference. And Jesus is the new Adam. You know, sometimes nowadays people have all kinds of funky ideas about husbands, and they may think that women can be husbands, but they can't. Husbands have to be male, and Christ is the new Adam, and the church, all of us taken together, the church is the new Eve, and the priest represents Jesus as the new Adam in relation to the congregation, the people of the church as the new Eve. So that's the nature of priestly identity. We could say a lot more about that. But because because priests are fathers and they represent the new Adam, Christ, who is the father of a new human race, and the church is his bride, and therefore our mother as individual members of the church, because of that, this male-female complementarity is expressed partly, it's part of the reality that the male priesthood expresses. So that's why only men can be priests, because only men can be husbands and only men can be fathers.
Now, this is a big question, Mary, so I want to go back to you. Does that help you? Is that satisfying to you?
Well, that is a doctrine of the church, correct? Not just a discipline.
Yes, yes. And in fact, John Paul II says it can't be changed, this is a constitutive aspect of the church. It's part of the very reality that the church, as Christ founded it. It's not like whether we say Mass in Latin or not, or, you know, whether we refrain from eating meat on Friday or that kind of thing. Those are all things that are subject to change. But this is something that, according to papal teaching, which has been reiterated by Pope Francis, this is not subject to change.
Mary.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much, Mary. Appreciate that. Again, our number 888-318-7884, September 26th through 29th. That will be the last weekend of September this year. Could be one of the best weekends of the year for you because it's beautiful weather here in San Diego and there's a wonderful conference here. Do you know what I'm talking about, Mark Brumley?
I've heard about this. This is a Catholic Answers Conference.
You are correct. And our theme this year is the early church was the Catholic Church.
That's right. It was.
I keep like saying to people, like, you mean that they had sacraments? Like, did they have seven sacraments in the earliest church? And it turns out, yes, they did. And I'm like, but it wasn't a hierarchical church. It wasn't a hierarchy. Like, Jesus didn't leave a hierarchy. And they, you know what they say to me? Yes, he did. So I got to go to this conference and find out all about that. Maybe you could
come
down.
So what are the dates again?
September 26th through 29th.
Excellent. I'm going to try to come down this year.
That would be very
nice.
I
had a conflict in my schedule last year, so I couldn't come.
Yeah, I think you were doing your hair or something like that, right? Something really important.
No, I was conferring with extraterrestrials.
Mark, you're a busy man.
I know.
We do have special early bird pricing right now through July 2nd, and seats are limited. I have checked this. This is a scientific fact. Seats are limited. Full conference ticket includes banquet dinner with keynote address by Bishop Caggiano, who's a wonderful speaker. Room rates are at $154 a night, which is an extraordinary rate for the Hyatt Regency La Jolla right here in beautiful, sunny San Diego. The early church was the Catholic Church. It really was. And come out and learn how to learn all about that and learn how to defend that fact in the public space. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
If there's one thing atheists and theists can agree on, it's the fact that we've all felt the problem of God's hiddenness and have cried out, "Where are you, God?" The difference, however, is atheists think this is a reason to reject God and theists don't. Why? Well, first, God is not entirely hidden. Sure, we can't know he exists by seeing or touching him, but we can know he exists through logic and reason. There's also good reason to believe God has revealed himself through Jesus of Nazareth. If Jesus is raised from the dead, then everything he said is true. Second, God's in-your-face presence wouldn't necessarily make things better. Even on the natural level, we don't like overbearing parents. Why would we want God to be that way? So while God's partial hiddenness is a mystery, it's not a good reason to embrace atheism. I'm Carlo Broussard with a Ready Reason for Catholic Answers. Catholic.com.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The only thing new about the heresies in the church and the schisms in the church today is it's mixed with satanic worship. We in the church have gone from enneagrams to centering prayer to solstice worship to goddesses. And you buy it as something new.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Mark Brumley is our guest this hour. He's the author of Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, and he is the president of Ignatius Press. The producers of some of the finest Catholic publications in the history of the earth. That seems right, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
History of the earth, yes.
In the history of the entire earth. 888. Well, I guess there's really only been, publishing and like book publishing for the last 500 years.
That's right. Of course, there were books before that.
There were books, but they were.
As in the Bible and other things, see?
But not like publishing like we have now. That was kind of printing press invented modern publisher.
That was,
am I
yes,
correct about
that's
that?
That's right. You are correct.
And
although the codex form of the book goes back
it's
to
farther than that.
Ancient
yeah.
times, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
right. But it wasn't until Thomas Edison invented the printing press that.
That's right.
Or was it Alexander Graham Bell?
1942.
I know it was American. I just don't know which one. Actually, Alexander Graham Bell was Scottish. We better give a call. I just have too much fun.
I hope our apologetics answers are better than our history answers.
No, I know that it wasn't Thomas Edison that invented the printing press. It was Sir Isaac Newton. Christina, listening on Emmanuel Radio, you are next. Your question for Mark Brumley.
Yes, I just want some advice. I have two nieces and a nephew that were not brought up Catholic, but two of them were baptized. And one day the oldest one came out and said that she did not believe in God, that when we die, that's it. We don't go to heaven or hell, that the Bible is nothing but a fairy tale. And all the other two kids seem to agree with her. Now, I'm in a situation where I am the only Catholic. Do I try to explain to these children what to believe, or just let them do this on their own? Because
okay.
it seems like if I bring something up in the family, I get jumped at.
Well, first, before I let Mark address your question, this is very, very common that we're hearing this now, children as young as 10 or 11 losing their faith. I have a question for you. Do they have smartphones?
Yes, they do.
Okay. Because this is what we're seeing is children, even before they get to middle school, are seeing these videos on YouTube and whatnot. And they're young. They're impressionable. Somebody says in a very confident way that this is all a fairy tale. And they have a naturally rebellious nature at that age. This is happening to a lot of young people. And I say this, I wanted to take a minute to say it, Christina, because a lot of parents are really having their heart broken waking up when the kid is 15 and realizing the kid's been watching these videos for years and something needed to be done before that. Now I will turn it over to Mark Brumley to address your question.
I would definitely, you know, keep praying for them. If your relationship is such that from time to time you can talk to them without people pouncing on you or thinking, you know, a lot of negative things about you, I try to do that. If they're going to be hostile, then you might direct them to some resources. If you have, you know, if they're willing to watch a video, something like that. Catholic Answers has tons of resources that you could provide them. I think you have even, I think Catholic Answers even even has things that can be viewed on a smartphone. Is that right?
We do, yes, right.
So,
right.
I'd say that. Is there someone else in their life that that they look up to that is a believer?
Well, no, I'm the only one. The mother and father don't have anything to do with the Catholic Church. My sister was baptized and had First Communion, but all of a sudden they've shifted their ways and they don't believe in organized religion. There's a lot of vulgar language in the family. It's just unbelievable me walking into this type of a household where I'm trying to, you know, set an example for the whole family, and it's very, very difficult. And like you said, the only thing I can do for them is pray. I pray for their souls. Because they're exposed to a lot of stuff on television, video games. I just wish I could do more, but that's why I'm just calling into this, say what, you know.
Yeah, and I think if you let them know that you're praying for them and you regard them, you know, you keep them in mind, you might give them, you know, something like UCAT, which is a youth catechism. I know sometimes parents or adults, when they're interacting with kids, they're hesitant to do things like that because they say, well, the kid's not going to read this book, or the kid's not going to listen to this audio CD, or the kid's not going to watch this video, and that can happen. But you'd be surprised that sometimes people do look at these things, and even if it doesn't happen for a number of years, they come across this thing. There's a point of crisis in their life, perhaps, or there's something that provokes interest on their part, and they start reading or watching or listening to something that can be life transforming. So I would encourage you to check out the resources that Catholic Answers has available for young people and, you know, give something as a gift.
Okay, Christina.
Thank you very much, and have a blessed Easter. Thank you so much.
You as well, Christina.
Thank you.
I know this is really, this is, you know, parents struggle with this, family members struggle with this all the time. I have to say that it's a challenge today because there's been a whole atmosphere in our culture in the media that has treated faith as if it were a fairy tale, and that means we have to improve our game. We can't just assume, as I think, unfortunately, a lot of Catholics, a lot of Christians more generally did 20, 30, 40 years ago, that, well, eventually the kids will grow out of this. You know, they when they get older and they get married, and they have to face questions about raising their own families, so they come back to the church. Yeah, that does sometimes happen, but it happens less often today than it did in the past. And so we have to have a different strategy for addressing the so-called nuns, N-O-N-E-S.
Right. And if there were somebody that had the quick answer, like, here's exactly, that person would be the, I mean, people would be beating a path to that person's door. Everyone is asking this. And
right.
And it's not, and some people would say, well, that's because, you know, I mean, sometimes we actually hear this response of, well, that's because, you know, we know more than we used to know, and these kids know more. Look, a kid raised on television and Avengers movies and their smartphone doesn't know more than a kid knew in the 1920s. That's not right. What's happening. It's because of what is on the smartphone that this is
right.
Happening. Nobody's arguing this is the smartest and most well-educated generation. I'm not putting them down. I'm just saying, look, if you've got media miseducating children year after year after year, you can't turn around and say, well, this is because we know more.
Right. There's the superficial impression that because they have access to, you know, a medium, the internet, where information is available, that if they're on the internet, therefore they're making use of that information. But in fact, as you say, much of what they encounter is an information. It's misinformation or disinformation. And that's why we have to be producing videos and making resources available, as Catholic Answers is doing and other apostolates are doing, so that these young people come across those things as well.
And I think in the Catholic Church, we just need four categories of people to be better at the faith. I think we just need maybe just three categories. Actually, I'll limit it to three. Priests and religious, laity. No, priests, religious, and laity. Those would be the three groups.
There you go.
If we could just get
I thought you were going to say 2.5 groups, but that's okay.
No, if we can get those three groups, priest, religious, and laity, to really live the faith, I think we got a chance. But it doesn't have to be anybody else, just those three groups. We just limit it to that.
And we need to find a balance between being concerned about young people's souls and on the other hand, making it all sort of depend upon us and us always having the right answers and so on. I mean, I find young people come across things, we have to make those things available, but they often encounter things which at first glance they push back from, they don't accept. But then, as I say, something happens. You know, they get a question from a friend or they're witnessed to by a young person and questions get raised in their minds and they start turning these resources and they, before you know it, they've undergone conversion. We can't rely on that happening just, you know, sort of willy-nilly. On the one hand, we have to be out there doing things. On the other hand, as they say, can't make it all about us.
Fair enough. Tyler in Colorado, listening on 1060 AM Ave Maria Radio, you are next up. Your question for Mark Brumley.
Hey, so through the past couple of years, me and my wife have come to understand that the Mass, and particular every Mass, is a miniature Easter, which is kind of throwing a couple of wrenches in things when we start to think about the Triduum and this upcoming Easter celebration. Do you guys have any input or suggestions on how interlocking the ordinary Mass with Easter without losing the sweetness of Easter, if that makes sense?
Well, I was going to say, let me ask you, Tyler, what is it about Easter and the Eucharist that you think understanding the Eucharist in terms of Easter, with reference to Easter, throws a wrench into things?
It doesn't feel as extraordinary.
Oh.
If every Mass is a miniature Easter, then the peak of Christian life doesn't feel as momentous.
Well, you can hear the music there, Tyler. Can you hang on through the break?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Mark Brumley is our guest. It is Open Forum this hour. We'll get to Tyler's question about Easter and the everyday celebration of the Eucharist right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament, from the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important. This pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Guys, it's your turn.
Let's hear about the important role of men in the church on tomorrow's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
For now, let's return to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Ignatius Press, one of the finest Catholic publishers in the history of the galaxy, has a book called St. Jose, Boy Cristero Martyr. I was just thinking, maybe that grandma could just get that book, St. Jose. Maybe one of the kids would read it.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. I don't know why that just came to me, because I don't know. A lot of people don't know the story. And if you're an adult, you should get this and read the story of St. Jose, who I won't be able to remember the last name. I'm not good with that kind of thing. But a Cristero martyr, like a kid who gave his life for Jesus during the struggle, all the religious struggles in Mexico. Great book, great kid. I think maybe this might light some heart. Just leave it lying around, see if they pick it up.
Absolutely. And, you know, the funny thing is, when I was in high school, I was an evangelical Protestant at that time. And, you know, I did a lot of apologetics as an evangelical. And sometimes I would give people C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity or give them different books like that. And I remember a friend of mine, I gave a copy of – what was that? Oh, boy. Now I can't think of the name of the book. Oh, it was a book – it's a book by Arthur C. Clarke, that had to do with, you know, the billion names of God or whatever it is, had a short story in it to that effect. And, you know, this is Arthur C. Clarke was not a Christian. He was not a believer. But this short story, for whatever reason, had it was 9 billion names of God. That's it. It had this effect on this friend of mine who wound up having a conversion experience as a result of reading this science fiction story.
Wow, so, God is good.
You know, things like this happen all the time. So we have to do our best to prep. I'm not saying you shouldn't be giving people copies of Mere Christianity, or you shouldn't be studying apologetic arguments or praying with people and all that. But we also have to realize that God can work through all kinds of things. So it's not all up to us. It's not like the whole future of the world is at stake if we don't get the best books out there and the best videos out there and the best audios and give them the best talks and take over the internet.
No, we've got to cooperate.
We do.
Yeah.
Eucharistic fast question.
But first, I got to say Sanchez del Rio.
Sanchez del Rio, yes.
That's St. Jose's last name, Sanchez del Rio. You should look him up if you don't know about him. Okay, so we were talking to Tyler about the connection between Big Easter right. Sunday, and Little Easter celebrated at every single Mass every day around the world.
And this happens. I mean, there are so many aspects of our faith where we have these sort of we have cycles, and the cycles in the church, you know, the church year, we go from the Annunciation and you know, that whole year, which is the story of the conception of Jesus, to the birth of Jesus celebrated at Christmas, through the life of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus, the suffering of Jesus in the wilderness, then Holy Week, the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Christ. There's a annual cycle that we follow, but there's also a weekly cycle where we have, Friday is a day of fasting and penance that calls to mind Good Friday. Every Friday is to be that. You know, whether you're abstaining from meat on Friday or doing some other form of penance, you should be doing some penance on Friday because it points to Good Friday. So there's a little mini Good Friday on every Friday of the year. And just likewise, there's a little Easter every Sunday of the year where we celebrate the resurrection of the Lord and the beginning of the new creation, the beginning of the new week of creation, which is what Sunday represents. So, and in fact, when we celebrate the Eucharist every day, the people who go to Mass every day, there is a certain sense in which every day becomes a little mini Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Jesus, because that's what the liturgy of the Holy Mass is about. So we have this pattern of smaller and small celebrations of the Paschal mystery that get expanded into larger celebrations of the Paschal mystery. And then we have the grand celebration of the Paschal mystery each year at the Easter Triduum. So I think that's just part of the pattern of Christian living.
Tyler, is that helpful to you? Nick, I need you to push line one for me. Tyler, did that help you?
Yes, I'm here. Yeah, I guess it's a little more time for some introspection would probably be beneficial.
Just a little closer to Jesus. Just keep moving closer to Jesus. It's not just introspection.
It is. But I would say, you know, it's like I love my wife. I should always be valuing my relationship with my wife. But yet we have a celebration each year of our wedding anniversary. So yeah, that's commemorating a specific day when we got married, but there's a certain sense in which every day should commemorate the commitment we made to one another, you know, many years ago at our wedding. The one doesn't take away from the other. In fact, they can be mutually deepening, and that should be likewise with respect to Mass. Going to daily Mass should deepen our going to weekly Sunday Mass, which should deepen our Easter celebration.
Tyler, thanks very much. I hope that was helpful to you. It is open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley is our guest. Taylor in Indianapolis, Indiana, listening on the Catholic Answers app. You are up next, Taylor. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Your question for Mark.
I want to say thank you guys both so much for taking my question today. And I actually converted and was baptized into the church last year, and Catholic Answers played a huge role in that. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you, Taylor, for sharing that with us. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks be to God.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So I have two questions. The first is, and kind of going back to a previous caller, I have a Protestant friend who is saying the passages in 1 Timothy and Corinthians that say that essentially women shouldn't be members of the clergy, trying to extrapolate those to the rest of society, saying women cannot be leaders above men in really any capacity. Specifically, this is in the case of a student organization. And then I have another Protestant friend on the other end of the spectrum saying there's essentially no difference between men and women, and that is going off of a passage in Galatians. So I was wondering if you could tell me how to respond to those, both of those positions.
Very carefully. That's how to respond. Because it is a complicated question. We have to represent, we have to recognize that God has created men and women equal. So there's a fundamental human equality. And all things that touch on that fundamental human dignity that we have as beings made in the image and likeness of God mean that men and women should be treated equally. Now, that hasn't always been the case in society and even in the church, but that's a fundamental truth. But that truth is not contrary to the truth that God has also made us in many respects different. So there is a kind of complementarity between men and women. In the Protestant world, sometimes there's this argument between what are called egalitarians and complementarians. So the egalitarians emphasize the equality of men and women, and the complementarians will emphasize the difference between men and women. And there's a kind of a severe, extreme view that says men and women are different in the complementarian view of things, and that men are better or in some way superior to women. Now, that's an extreme view. It's not the view that's common to most complementarians, but nevertheless, these are realities, the tendencies, and the egalitarian and complementarian views, I believe, can be reconciled, and I believe they are reconciled in the Catholic understanding of things. There are other Christians who similarly reconcile them, but we would say, yes, there's a fundamental equality of men and women, so whatever is true of human beings qua human beings, that's equally true of men and women, because men and women are equally human. But that said, that doesn't mean that they're identical in the way in which their humanity is expressed and lived and so on. There's a fundamental difference between, say, being a mother, and a fundamental difference between being a father. And those women who've born children for 9 months will testify to this. And so there's a basic difference. So we want to keep both of those things in view. Now, with respect to Scripture, we have to understand that Scripture is speaking from and to a primarily patriarchal society. That word patriarchal there isn't wholly bad, but it's not completely good. There's not everything about patriarchal societies was wrong, but not everything about patriarchal societies was right or good. So we live in a society that tends to be more egalitarian, and that is to say, we tend to understand better the equality of men and women. In some ways, our society, though, understands more poorly the complementarity of men and women, whereas societies in the ancient Near East tended to understand the difference between men and women very well, and they tended to prioritize certain things about men, and that included social roles. So with respect to St. Paul, 1 Corinthians, 1 Timothy, he's speaking in the context of what was commonly accepted with respect to social roles between men and women at that time. The fact that those social roles no longer obtain today in our society doesn't mean then that all bets are off, that because women teach in our society publicly and women in those societies at that time didn't teach publicly, the fact that there's a difference there and that we think our society, for reasons that are complex, you know, has it right, doesn't mean that now there are no differences between men and women. So for the Catholic view tends to be a both-and approach, affirming both the equality of men and women and the complementarity of women, men and women. And we're going to work towards a society that properly distinguishes what is true about the differences between men and women and the equality of men and women from false ideas that lots of people have. And that takes time. It's taken centuries. But, you know, the impetus, I would say, and I think there are lots of different places you could go to see this expressed, but the impetus for a proper understanding of the equality of men and women has come from the Christian understanding that every human being is made in the image and likeness of God. That wasn't universally affirmed, certainly in the ancient world. It has come to be widely affirmed over a long period of time, partly as a result of the teaching of the church. Have we always lived up to that? No. Have we made serious mistakes? Yes. But today we're in danger of falling off the other side of the horse, thinking that the equality of men and women requires treating them in all respects as if they're identical, and thus denying the complementarity and the fundamental difference. So it's just a long historical process, and it's something that when we talk to other Christians or other people about it, it takes time. We have to make distinctions, and that can be challenging. I hope that I haven't gone too far afield from your question, Taylor.
Taylor?
No, that was helpful. I feel like you really addressed how to talk to the friend who's more on the complementarian end, but the friend that's more mm-hmm. on the egalitarian end, who's saying that
right.
women cannot be leaders really in any capacity where they're ever going to be over men. This is in the case of a student organization. So having women on the board of a student organization or as the president of a student organization, how should I respond to that friend?
Yeah, I just simply say, well, God made us equal. And, in the scripture, I think it's true to say, if you go to Galatians chapter 3:15, which speaks of, in Christ there's neither male nor female. I think the significance of that verse is with respect to the order of grace, there is no distinction. We all have access to grace, whether we're men and women, slave or free, Jew or Greek. Grace is available to everyone. Now, and everyone is an equal member of the new covenant, participates in the new covenant. I would say that we see in the New Testament, obviously there are certain women that exercise a kind of leadership role. They didn't do everything in the early church, but that's to some degree, I mean, certainly with respect to ordination, that is not something that is simply culturally conditioned or expression of the culture. Other things were, though, and we don't live in that culture anymore. So we shouldn't act as if we do. That's what I'd say. Now, because you're dealing with non-Catholics, you're dealing with Protestants, it's going to be very difficult because they're going to want to, the answer has to be from the Bible alone. And the Bible can be taken in different ways in this regard. And I think you see that with respect to your friends. I just simply say, well, why can't women, to the extent that in 1 Timothy, where Paul's talking about teaching authority, he's talking about teaching in the exercise of the liturgy. He's not talking about, just in general in society. And so it's a little difficult for me to understand how somebody could take that passage and think it applies to women exercising leadership roles in, say, the pro-life movement or something like that. But you're going to have a difficult challenge because these are people that are really starting from kind of a non-Catholic premise in understanding the Bible. And so you just have to work through it.
Thanks very much. Go ahead, Mark.
That's the best I could do.
You can see the problem, though, with a Protestant person relying entirely on Scripture. But even in Scripture, you're just going to have to work harder, but you'll be able to find.
Yeah, you have to work at it.
Yeah,
you have to show how the principle of fundamental equality and the fact that those principles were applied in different historical situations gives rise to the question, well, is our historical situation changed? Just like Paul talks to slaves and tells them to be subservient to their masters. Well, we would say, in our society, that the principle that Paul is trying to work out there, be at peace with people in positions of authority so that you can witness to them. But that is not a blank check that approves slavery. So we just as we wouldn't try to endorse slavery today, so with respect to some of these other issues, we shouldn't try to endorse the social structure of that time. Anyway, that's what I'd say.
Thanks very much, Taylor, for that question. We got to take a quick break. Our annual spring store-wide sale is still underway. Everything from Catholic Answers is on sale right now. Just put in promo code SPRING19 when you check out at shop.catholic.com, and you get 15% off your whole order. SPRING19 when you check out at shop.catholic.com, and save on everything.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
Suffering is, instead of seeing it as a participation in Christ's passion in union with his redeeming sacrifice on the cross, we see it as, oh, we have to avoid pain, we have to avoid suffering. People need to think that it's not about avoiding suffering that we think is meaningless. It's about finding meaning in the suffering that's unavoidable.
Morning Glory. Talking about everything important to today's Catholic. Tomorrow morning, 7 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum. Mark Brumley here with us, and lots of people to get to, so I'm going to just get to them. Courtney in Dallas, Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. You are up next. Your question for Mark Brumley.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Happy to.
I was reading through Genesis, and just kind of got stopped up in chapter 16, which is
Hagar.
The chapter that talks about Abraham and, yeah. And I guess the thing that my question, it's kind of the whole chapter, because it just kind of seems, the whole thing kind of just seems unjust. And so I was curious, like, the historical context, I know all of that, but it just seems.
Who seems, you know, to you to be unjust in that? Is it Sarah, Abraham, Hagar, or the angel?
I feel like all of them.
Everybody. Everybody's being unjust there.
It seems I think Abraham is committing adultery with Hagar.
Yeah, he is. He did.
And
I think that's true.
Pregnant, they're angry at each other, and then she blames Abraham, and it's just like, what is going on? And so I guess I just feel like there's a lot of fault to go around.
Boy,
and
is there.
So I just wanted to,
there is, but not the angel. Everybody but the angel. Mark, that's what I'm going to argue.
I think the angel gets off okay. I think the angel is dealing with the situation with these muddled human beings. But
right.
Look, the Bible depicts all kinds of bad things, and even people who are in many respects or in other respects good and commendable, Abraham was good and commendable with respect to his faith, nevertheless oftentimes do bad things. And either they do bad things by their own standards, so they have a certain understanding of what's right and wrong, which may not be as solid as ours, and they still violate their own standards of right and wrong, or they're acting according to their standards of right and wrong. But we, with the fuller vision that's come through Jesus, or even just, several books later in the Bible, in the next book of the Bible, Exodus, where we have the Ten Commandments, we have a better understanding. Yeah, they do some pretty unjust things, and I think this is an example of one of them.
Yeah, so just so nobody misses what we're talking about, Sarah, at the time called Sarai, is not able to have children. She encourages Abraham to sleep with her slave Hagar, but it also says Mary. So I don't know exactly how you interpret that, Mark. And then when Hagar becomes pregnant, she starts lording it over Sarai, like, ha ha, I'm the big deal now because I'm pregnant.
I've got a child.
And then Sarai responds by being really mean to Hagar, driving her out. And Abraham acts like none of this has anything to do with me.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's
work
a mess.
It out, ladies.
Courtney, have I described correctly what you read?
Yeah, exactly. And I have, I mean, I guess then that makes sense. So then my follow-up is then the product of that, you know, fault is Ishmael, which if I understand correctly, he's kind of like the, like through his line of descendants is what we believe is leads to like the Islam religion, right?
No, I wouldn't. I'll let you answer that, Mark, but it's you and me. We're
well, yeah, that's an over that's a oversimplification, but yeah, I mean it's a different line than obviously that came through Sarai, but nevertheless, the child is a blessing. In fact, that's implied, you know that but there's still going to be all kinds of issues, as there are issues with all of the descendants of Abraham. But Hagar does not her offspring. Ishmael is not cursed or anything simply because, because Abraham did what he did, but he created a problem, and Sarai created a problem too by the way that they went about trying to respond to the promise that God made to Abraham. In other words, they tried to take the matter into their own hands instead of trusting in God. If they had trusted in God, this conflict that God created would not have occurred. But God is not caught off guard. His providence is at work, and he's able to bring great good out of bad situations and choices that human beings make. But I think you're basically right that there you see a lot of injustice in the interaction among these people.
That's not
– Okay, and so it's not that Ishmael was he was not – because there's a passage there that says – you know, the son basically will, your offspring will be a wild ass of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him, in opposition to all his kin shall he encamp. So it's...
Right. That's just a fact.
Because I read that and kind of thought
that's what happened later on, and through his descendants, it's describing what's going to happen. But it's not like God cursed him or anything of that sort. This is what happened, and it often happens when we do things outside of God's plan, and we take matters into our own hands. We bring a conflict into the situation, not just with respect to ourselves, but sometimes other people, including our descendants. And again, God is able to bring good out of it. He's able to save the world through our misuse of freedom. That's what put his son on the cross. So the fact that God can bring good out of a bad situation doesn't justify the bad situation to begin with or the choices that the people made. And I think that with respect to Abraham and Sarai and Hagar applies.
Courtney, I love your call. It's just great reading through the book of Genesis, and it's not all easy. It's not all easy. I really appreciate that call. Anonymous in Sacramento, watching on Facebook Live, you are up next. You might have to be kind of quick. Your question for Mark Brumley, Anonymous.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
Hello. Yes. My question was regarding the dogma of the Immaculate Conception and whether, I guess, like, does it not, deprive the Virgin of her, like, of her virtue because she does it, like, because it puts her into, like, a separate, like, class of humans that, like, can't sin and, like, for no, like, you know, merit of herself. She's different, which would make Christ different from us.
Well, I think it does put her in a different class in the sense that she's a wholly redeemed person. She was given graces that no one else was given, and those graces were consistent with her freedom. Now, how grace and freedom work together is a difficult topic, even if we had an hour to talk about it, but they are compatible. We shouldn't see grace as overriding freedom. But see grace as enabling and equipping us to be free. So actually the Blessed Virgin, because of the Immaculate Conception, was the most free human person that ever lived. But we'll have to explore that at another time.
Anonymous, sorry we ran out of time on you there, but thank you very much for that question. Sorry to everybody else, too. You're very popular today, Mark. There's a lot of folks on the line we weren't able to get to.
Maybe next time.
But man, what a great hour. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
And now onwards to the Passion and Resurrection of the Lord.
Blessed Holy Week to you.
You too, Mark. Thank you very much. Mark's book is The Seven Deadly Sins of Apologetics, and he is the president of Ignatius Press, which you can find at ignatius.com. Com. Okay, I wasn't sure if it was a com or an org. We will see you tomorrow, God willing, on Catholic Answers Live.